Oh, you didn't mean he hooked who put it in
the song.
Oh, okay.
The song, yeah.
The song. Yeah, what is the song?
Go with
your bags.
Huh? Go with your bags.
Thank you.
Oh, we give thanks.
Oh, we give thanks.
For this precious day.
For this precious day.
We're all gathered here.
We're all gathered here.
For those far away.
For those far away.
For this time we share.
For this time we share.
With love and care.
With love and care.
Oh, we give thanks.
Oh, we give thanks.
For this precious day.
For this precious day.
Oh, we give thanks.
Oh, we give thanks.
Precious day.
For this precious day,
we're all gathered here,
we're all gathered here,
and those far away,
and those far away,
for this time we share,
for this time we share,
with love and care,
with love and care,
we give thanks,
oh, we give thanks,
for this precious day,
for this precious day.
Thank you, Dick. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. Whether you're a long-time established member, relatively new to the fellowship, or just visiting, please know that you are among friends, and we welcome you to this safe haven for spiritual, intellectual, and emotional growth. Today we are taken into the story of Passover, or Pesach, one of the most commonly observed Jewish holidays, even by otherwise non-observant Jews. The name Pesach means to pass through or pass over, to exempt or to spare. As we will learn today, Passover celebrates God passing over the houses marked in the way he directed when he was slaying the firstborn of Egypt. I don't know if any of that rings a bell. I came into this not knowing anything about Passover. I see Wynn, expert over there. So I had to reach back and think about movies I'd seen in the past. And you know, the 40 years in the desert, the Ten Commandments, the manna from heaven, parting of the sea, it's a biggie. If none of that rings a bell, and that's okay, because it's a pretty wild ride we're on today, and we'll get the whole story. Even if you're fully versed in the Passover story, I'm confident you'll be exposed to new thoughts and ideas as it relates to the struggles of many people and the freedoms that they hope to attain. So welcome on this beautiful Sunday morning. A couple of quick announcements. Our annual meeting is immediately following the service. If you could go grab a cup of coffee or tea, I think I saw cookies, I'm not really sure, maybe some cheese, and be ready back in here, be ready by about 12:15 so we can get the party started. And then we've got the work day on Saturday, May the 14th, and that is you come out here and get grungy and hot and sweaty, and the only thing you get in return is knowing that you did a good job and you did it for the fellowship, and it's worth it. So May 14th, we have people work inside, outside, and typically pretty small crowds. We could really use a big crowd this year. So please, if you can. If you can't, that's okay. So lighting of the chalice today, I'd like to read a poem called "For Holy Days on Which We Recall the Old Stories" by Delman Baker Sorrells. For holy days on which we recall old stories, we light the flame. For Passover, which reminds us of the courage and strength of those seeking freedom in the past, we light the flame. For Easter, which reminds us that love is our greatest challenge, we light the flame. For gathering today in this sacred place, we light the flame. For the opportunity to be together as a community, to remember the past, to plan our future, to be alive in our present. So if you'd rise as you're willing and or able, and we're going to sing, the opening hymn is 212, We Are Dancing Sarah's Circle.
Thank you.
And now it's time for our joys and sorrows. We welcome you to share a significant joy or sorrow in your life. Sharing will ensure your celebration will be shared by everyone here today. If it's a sorrow, sharing will spread the burden and will hopefully remind you that you are not alone. Please wait for the microphone. Looks like Mark has it today.
For those of you who don't know me, my name is Edith Hendricks, and I have come, I have been a member for many, many, many years in the fellowship here, and I have come to live with my son, Stephen, and his wife, Jada, permanently. So you'll see my face, as ugly as it is, many, many times, I hope.
For our newer members who do not know this, Edith made our collection baskets.
I brought some matzah as a symbol of Passover, so you can all have a taste of it when you're having your refreshments to see what unleavened bread was in the Sinai Desert.
After 5 years of working on my master's, I successfully defended my thesis on April 11th, and I am all done.
Maya turned 7 on April 20th, and yesterday she celebrated her birthday at a party with 12 friends? We had a blast.
I'm Kathy Hedge. I have a sorrow to share. I've been a little bit absent. My niece suddenly passed away, and at the end of February, but she was able to donate her organs and helped many families. So it was tough going through that, but she's living on in other ways.
For those joys you've shared, we celebrate with you. For those sorrows you've shared with us, and for those kept private, we share in your sorrow and are here for you. We will keep you in our thoughts and our prayers. And now, back by popular demand, the UUFM singers singing their anthem, Deep River.
the great move about. And guess what comes next? Really? Okay, as soon as they get that stuff settled down, because I don't want you to get in their way, here they go.
How many use as a take?
Right. It seems to be settled. We didn't set anything on fire, so children, you can come up for the story. Maybe Rhea thinks she's far enough up. So, now in that little introduction, they said something about a holiday. What holiday are we talking about? No. Passover. Passover, that's the one. Now, who celebrates Passover? The Jews. Okay. Okay. And what is the story? There's a name of the story that goes with Passover. What is that? The name of the story? Anybody know that? It was a Bob Marley album. Exodus. Exodus. Do you know what Exodus means? It means going out of. So this is a story about people going out of a place. And the story is that the Hebrews, who are also called the Israelites, who are also called the Jews, were enslaved. And do you know where they were enslaved? Egypt. They were enslaved in Egypt. And there was a big leader of Egypt. And what was he called? Pharaoh. I heard somebody say Pharaoh. Yeah, he was called Pharaoh. So the big leader of Egypt was Pharaoh. And he was a really, really mean guy. I mean, he was afraid of the slaves getting too populous, and they actually killed some of the babies. That's ridiculous. But there was one baby that got hidden in a basket. Does anybody remember his name? Moses, yes. Moses got hidden in a basket, and who found him?
A lady.
A lady, yeah. Do you know what lady? Do you know? It was Pharaoh's daughter found him in this basket, and she said, "Oh, it must be one of the Hebrew children. I'm going to take him and raise him as my own." So she took him and raised him in the palace, and she got, oh, who's this girl, little girl watching over this baby? Do you know? It's his sister Miriam. And so she said, "Oh, I'll get you a nursemaid." And she ran and got his mother, and so his mother came to the court with him and helped raise him. His actual mother. But now he was really kind of mixed there. He was raised as an Egyptian by the Egyptian princess, but he also was raised as a Hebrew there in the court. And he didn't like how the Pharaoh was treating the people. And in fact, he saw somebody mistreating a slave and he killed him. And then he ran off. And away from Egypt, where he wouldn't have any penalties. And he went out and he became a shepherd. And he got a family. And then one day he saw something. What did he see? A flaming bush. He saw a burning bush. And even though it was burning, it didn't get burned up. And God talked to him out of the flaming bush. Do anybody know what God told him? Yeah, he said to go back to Egypt and ask Pharaoh. What's he going to ask Pharaoh? To let my people go. Oh, let's say that. Let my people go. Let my people go. He went to ask Pharaoh to let my people go. Did Pharaoh let the people go?
No.
No, Pharaoh didn't let the people go. And so what happened when Pharaoh didn't let the people go? No, but we're getting close to that. Plagues. What were the plagues? All kinds of bad things happened to the Egyptians. The river turned to blood. Ah! There were frogs everywhere. Frogs jumping around everywhere. Then there was a plague of gnats. Now, I can relate to that plague of gnats. I know sometimes in the summertime when they just crowd up in clouds. So plagues of gnats. And then there was a plague of flies. And then the livestock died. And then they got boils. Have you ever had a boil? Oh, you don't want to have a boil, do you? Oh, they're awful, awful. So they had this plague of boils. Then they had a plague of hail. Have you ever been out in the hail?
No.
Oh, that's a pretty awful thing. That ice just pelting down on you. Huh? There were 10 of them. So then there was the locusts. Huh. The locusts were eating all the grain and everything. And then there's a plague of darkness. Everything got completely dark. Darkness filled the whole land. And still, Moses said, "Let my people go." And what did Pharaoh say?
No.
No. Then came the worst, awfulest plague, which was that every firstborn child, every firstborn son was killed, except for the Hebrews who did signs so that they would know to pass over them. That's where the word Passover came from. So Pharaoh finally said, okay, go. You're just too many curses here. So they went, but then the Egyptians ended up chasing them. So what did they do? They ran through the Red Sea, and what happened there? Yeah, exactly. It parted for them to go through, and they went through, but the Egyptians couldn't make it. And so they went out into the desert, and they wandered in the desert. Now, what are you going to eat in the desert? Cacti. Good suggestion. That is what I would eat in the desert. They got manna from heaven, which, you know, we don't really know exactly what it was supposed to be, but it looks like it's this little white stuff. So they were collected manna. Another thing that happened while they were out in the desert, they went to Mount Sinai, and the law was given to them. They got the law. And so now, and eventually, they got to the promised land. But it took like 40 years. So a lot of the people who were free didn't get there, but their children did. And so today, we have Passover Seders to celebrate this freedom of the Israelites. And this is a picture of the Passover Seder that was at the White House. So that is the quick story. And thank you all for helping me tell it, because I know you learned that this year. So we're ready to go to our classes.
Offertory, an offering. Thank you. So I'd like to offer up a bit of a primer on Passover. I needed to do some research, as I said, and so I wrote some of it down. As I mentioned earlier, Passover is one of the most commonly observed Jewish holidays, even by otherwise non-observant Jews. And it's estimated about two-thirds of American Jews routinely host or attend a Passover Seder, which is the traditional feast, while only about half belong to a synagogue, so it has wide appeal. Probably the most significant observance related to Passover involves avoiding chametz, or leaven, throughout the holiday. This commemorates the fact that the Jews were leaving Egypt in a hurry and did not have time to let their bread rise. It's also a symbolic way to remove the puffiness or arrogance or pride from their souls. The Seder, the ceremonial feast held on the first two nights of Passover, is one of the most intricate rituals of the Jewish calendar, kicking off an 8-day stretch of complicated and demanding dietary restrictions. The initial meal, which ranges from eating bitter herbs to reciting Talmudic passages in foreign languages in a foreign language, usually lasts for several hours, and dinner isn't served until more than halfway through. And as I understand it, there are no appetizers, so it's quite a chore. I was amazed at the complexity of the Seder. The festival commemorates the Exodus from Egypt, a key step in the formation of the Jewish people. The Seder is not just a retelling of the story, like the weekly Torah readings in synagogue are. Instead, it's more of an invitation for Jews to relive the liberation from slavery, as if they had actually been there in Egypt. It's used to teach the narrative to the next generation and to claim the history of their people as part of their own individual identities. As Jews have become integrated into mainstream society, it's not surprising that some Jewish customs have seeped into the mainstream. Non-Jewish spouses, college friends, co-workers, neighbors are often invited to the Passover Seders. In fact, the evening's traditional service begins with an invitation to let all those who are hungry come and eat, which is both an open invitation to the meal and an invocation to all guests to open themselves up to be truly present at the Seder. But for many, the allure of Passover stretches beyond that Jewish ritual. The Seder itself and the themes it explores have a way of resonating outside the boundaries of the tribe. Christians relate to the Seder on a couple of levels. On the symbolic side, the motif of the sacrificial lamb, whose blood was painted on the Israelites' door frames to ensure they were passed over during the killing of the firstborn, resonates with the image of Jesus as the Lamb of God, who suffered in order to save others. On the historic side, Jesus and most of his disciples were Jewish, and their Last Supper is widely thought to have been a Passover Seder. Just as the Seder allows Jews to relive the Exodus, the ceremony allows Christians to recreate the Last Supper, and so the Passover becomes a living event for them. With its wider theme of slavery and liberation, the celebration, the ceremony has meaning for non-religious people too. The Seder's motifs, matzah as the bread of affliction, which we'll have today, thank you, salt water as the tears of oppression, and bitter herbs as the harshness of slavery, can be especially evocative for Black Americans. Dr. Martin Luther King once said, I quote, "The segregationists and racists make no fine distinction between the Negro and the Jew," unquote. The Seder has great significance for the African American community, which has also suffered slavery, achieved redemption, and continues to struggle for the equal standing in society. Other ethnic and cultural groups embrace the Seder as a struggle for equality, tolerance, and freedom. The LGBT community, Latin American farm workers, feminists, and environmentalists, just to name a few. So we're all going to learn something today of that, I'm sure. Enjoy John Liu's insights into the Passover. Then I would encourage you to go find more information on Passover and how others have embraced the notion of Pesach to tell their story. So our next hymn is number 104. If you'll stand as you're able, join us.
When there is a loss in Egypt's land, let my
So, as our Jewish friends celebrate Passover this week, it's a good time to consider our relations to Judaism. Now, relations between UUs and Jews have long been close, actually. The need for unity with Jews and even with Muslims was one of Unitarian Michael Servetus' arguments against the Trinity back in the 16th century. Today, it's rare to find a UU congregation without someone who grew up Jewish. I'm sure there are people here who have Jewish connections. Are there people here who have Jewish connections? Yeah. And if you go out east, where Jews are more populous, a whole lot of them join UU congregations, enough that there's a term they've adopted for themselves, Junitarians. One congregation, the Arlington Street Church in Boston, even has a rabbi as associate clergy, something that my professor of Judaism from Div School strenuously objects to. But when I went to divinity school, I thought I knew something about Judaism. I'd been raised in a good Baptist family and been to Sunday school for years and read the Bible and study materials and knew the stories from the Old Testament and even had Jewish friends with whom I never talked about religion. Turns out I didn't know much at all about Judaism, or what I thought I knew about Judaism needed a whole lot of correction from people who had actually studied the tradition, like some of the Jewish friends I met in school and since, with whom I did talk religion, and more formally, particularly Hebrew scholar and professor John Levinson. I learned that the people who taught me about Judaism were Christians. Of course, duh. Why didn't I realize that? But it's significant because they approached Judaism from a particular Christian perspective, mostly an evangelical perspective, which tended to be supersessionist. If you know nothing else about the relationship between Christianity and Judaism, you need to understand supersessionism. It's not only a belief, but an attitude that fuels anti-Semitism, and since it came into being so early in Christianity, it infiltrates, poisons, and corrupts it, much as slavery and the subjugation of Native Americans corrupted the democratic values of this nation. Supersessionism claims that though the Jews were God's chosen people, they lost that role when Christianity came along, and Christians replaced or superseded the Jews as God's favorites. Now you can see how that belief could have a negative effect on the relation between Christians and Jews. It shows up boldly and subtly in many ways. One way is interpreting the Hebrew scriptures through the lens of the New Testament, which begins in the New Testament itself, and saying Isaiah is only about predictions of Jesus' birth without examining Isaiah for what the prophet was saying in his time and place and what that meant for the Jewish people. Even labeling the Hebrew scriptures as the Old Testament is supersessionist, interpreting Jesus as a break from Jewish tradition rather than as a part of Jewish tradition often results in supersessionism. The old way was legalism, the new way is love. You've heard stuff like that, right? The God of wrath versus the God of love. Those are supersessionist sentiments. They are saying, Judaism is out, Christianity is in, God loves us, not them. That's essentially what it's saying. And contrary to the assertions of many Christians through the centuries, Judaism does not naturally culminate in Christianity. Passover has its own particular brand of supersessionism, where Jewish Passover practices are co-opted into the celebration of Jesus' Last Supper with his disciples, which is not to say that the Eucharist itself is a problem, but when Passover is depicted only as a part of the workup to Easter, there's a problem. And that's one reason it's good that Passover and Easter sometimes fail to converge, and as is true this year. So it gives us an excellent chance to view each holiday in its independent wholeness. Now, to be fair, many progressive Christians, both Catholic and Protestant, have worked to strip their religion of supersessionism. acknowledging Judaism as a religion in its own right rather than just a preface to Christianity. And many have apologized for their tradition's role in this support for anti-Semitism. Some of those apologies have been wanting. One rabbi described the Vatican's new doctrine on Christians and Jews this way. He said it was a unilateral pronouncement by one party which presumes to redress on its own terms a wrong it does not admit. But some have worked to eradicate it from their liturgies. Some theologians argue that Paul himself was a supersessionist. Others see the beginnings of it in the Gospels, especially in John and Matthew. And at the time those books were written, remember, the Christians were Jews. They were Jewish Christians. And they were vying with the rabbis for Jewish adherence. So it was Jews talking about Jews. And later, after Christians dominated Christianity, they took those texts. And the early church fathers like Justin Martyr, Origen, and Tertullian made clear statements of supersessionism. The result, over and over again, through history, has been a theological justification for anti-Semitism. If Judaism is passé, what do you do with the Jews who are left? Ideas make a difference in the world. Don't let anyone tell you that they don't matter. They do. The contemporary Jewish scholar, Amy Jill Levine, has been extremely helpful in placing Jesus and the development of Christianity into the Jewish milieu in which he actually emerged. And she documents how Jesus was consistent with Judaism, how Jewish roots shaped Christian doctrine. And more biblical scholars and historians of Christianity have replaced the supersessionist underpinnings of Christianity with a deeper understanding of bridges between Christianity and Judaism. Judaism need not be maligned in order for Christianity to be embraced. But let's take a look. If Christianity doesn't supersede Judaism, what is the actual historical relationship? In fact, if we examine the history of the traditions, we're really talking about three religious traditions in a way. Because Temple Judaism, that was the form of Judaism that was practiced while there was a temple standing in Jerusalem. In a way, it's the mother of two different religions, one being rabbinic Judaism and the other being Christianity. And when the Romans destroyed the second temple in the year 70 CE, they threw Judaism into a crisis. Without the temple, key aspects of the religion could not be practiced. The temple was the symbol that all the people rallied around. And even the people who were dispersed across the empire, people came to temple on significant holidays, including Passover, to bring sacrifices and affirm themselves as a single people. The loss of the temple robbed them of all this. It created a crisis of identity. People, though, are resilient, right? When their cultural foundations are torn away from them, they find new ways to interpret life and make meaning. So the Jewish people looked to other aspects of their tradition, gathered around teachers who made sense to them, and found new ways. The major way that Jews found was rabbinic Judaism. And then there were a few Jews who helped to inaugurate Christianity. Now, at first, the Jews practicing Christianity didn't set aside their Jewish roots, but as more and more Gentiles came into Christianity, Judaism was left behind. So you have these two different religions, rabbinic Judaism and Christianity, that both came after Temple Judaism and kind of came out of those. And both are equal and different. Christianity, of course, organized itself around the figure of Jesus, a Jewish prophet crucified by the Roman Empire. Rabbinic Judaism organized itself around the texts, the Torah, the prophets and the writings, the law. Christianity organized itself as a missionary enterprise associated with a strong Roman state, reaching out to all people regardless of their ethnicity or homeland. And Judaism organized itself as a people, as an ethnic group who found their identity in their scriptures and in their stories, the cultural influences that had shaped their traditions, mores, and identity. So Judaism has a character completely distinct from Christianity. Jews do not interpret the Hebrew scriptures in the same way the Christians do, same way the Christians read the Old Testament, even though those sets of books are essentially the same. They're not read the same. Judaism does not parallel Christianity. Hanukkah, for example, a very minor religious holiday, would barely merit mention if it didn't happen to occur near Christmas. And the big holy days of Judaism come in the fall with Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and that's when Jews go to synagogue or temple, the big communal religious observance. But the holiday that Jews celebrate at home with lots of hoopla and merriment, as Mark said, that's Passover. It's as important to Jews as Christmas is to Christians. Even totally secular Jews go to Passover Seders. And culturally, the Passover defines the Jewish people. They are the people who were freed from Egypt and wandered in the desert. These are foundational stories. This is the way it reads in Deuteronomy 26, the Jewish Publication Society's version. A wandering Aramean was my father, and he went down into Egypt and sojourned there, few in number. And he became there a nation, great, mighty, and populous. And the Egyptians dealt ill with us and afflicted us and laid upon us hard bondage. And we cried unto the Lord, the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice and saw our affliction and our toil and our oppression. And the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm and with great terribleness and with signs and with wonders. And he hath brought us into this place and hath given us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And now, behold, I have brought the first of the fruit of the land which thou, O Lord, hast given me. So those are the ritual words that went with the presentation of first fruits brought to the temple for the celebration of Passover. It's kind of the Cliff Notes version of the whole story. Today, the celebration is different, not in the temple, but in the home among family and friends, as Mark told us. The Seder reenacts the Passover each year, as if the family gathered round the table personally came out of Egypt. It's identification with ancestors and identification with the oppressed. In the present, the Seder redefines and reinterprets the history. To quote Jewish feminist scholar Judith Plaskow, scholars may debate whether there was an exodus from Egypt, what proportion of the future Israelite community dwelt in Egypt, and how the exodus narrative became part of Jewish experience. Whatever they decide, however, the exodus story as a story is constitutive for Jewish self-understanding. As such, it has a claim on contemporary Jews who must wrestle with its meaning. It is in telling the story of our past as Jews that we learn who we truly are in the present. So the story becomes the foundation of the Jewish people's identity as a free people emancipated from slavery. But that's not where it ended. It's such a good story that others adopted it, especially the Christians whose roots were also in early Judaism. So the story of a people so oppressed that they have been enslaved and exploited, a leader rises from their midst, a leader who, because of accident of his birth, has been raised by the royal family, and who, because of his impulsive murder of an Egyptian overseer, has exiled himself to the desert. Then Moses gets the call to rescue his people, to demand their freedom, and he gets special tricks from God to help him accomplish the liberation. But it's not over once they cross the Red Sea. Instead, they wander in the wilderness for 40 years. And in Bible speak, that doesn't mean literally 40 years. 40 is just the number that they say, a really long time, really, really long time. And during that time, they learn lessons of what it means to be free. They establish the law at Sinai. They develop leaders other than Moses. They become a people. And ultimately, they cross into the Promised Land, but only after many of those who were originally freed have died. So it's their children who actually make it. It's a dramatic story, an epic story. a story that many came to relate to, even those from outside the Jewish tradition. There's a kind of history of texts that's called reception history. It looks at how passages like those in the Bible have been received and interpreted and used by people. So Exodus has a rich reception history. Christians claim the story. Even the founders of this country, some of whom were drifting toward post-Christian with their deism and Unitarianism, but they were taking cues from the English Puritans, who during the English Civil War had proclaimed Oliver Cromwell to be their Moses. And in 1776, as the founders sought symbols for a seal of the independent country, both deist Benjamin Franklin and Unitarian Thomas Jefferson argued for a seal that drew on the Exodus story. Franklin wanted a picture of Moses splitting the sea while Pharaoh drowned, and Jefferson argued for the children of Israel being led by a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Now, what does the founding of this nation, what does that have to do with the Exodus story? The founders saw themselves as being freed from something near to slavery to England. And so they identified with the Israelites. They identified, as so many people have through the years. Now, of course, the closest parallels in this country was that of actual slavery. Now, I find Denmark Vesey's story compelling. He bought his own freedom in 1799, determined to end the practice of slavery in Charleston, South Carolina. Now, Vesey was free, but his wife and children were still enslaved because her master wouldn't sell. So Vesey started his personal rebellion by leaving the white church. Vesey, along with a bunch of other Charleston blacks, tired of those oppressive practices. They didn't like hearing the words of St. Paul, "Servants, obey your masters," which was pretty much what got preached to them. And they started their own African Methodist Episcopal, AME, church, which grew to well over 1,000 members. Now, Vesey was not a preacher or a minister, but he led class meetings in his home, and he drew unceasingly on the story of the Exodus, proclaiming the African slaves to be the new Israelites. In a way, it was an early use of what in the 20th century would be called liberation theology, where a group gathers and reads the stories and asks how is that story playing out in their own lives, finding their experience of oppression there. So living into the stories, they sought solutions to the power imbalances in their own lives. So it happened with 20th century Latin American Catholics, and it happened with 19th century African American slaves and freedmen like Vesey. He teamed up with an Angolan healer, Gullah Jack, to recruit and strengthen warriors to lead a slave rebellion. As it happened, other blacks reported them, and Vesey, with some of the other leaders, was hanged. And significantly, the white Charleston leaders broke up and raised the church, this 1,000-member church. Clearly, they believed that these religious ideas, like the story of Exodus, were responsible for a potential uprising. Abolitionists like Harriet Beecher Stowe and Frederick Douglass, they built on the Exodus imagery. Spiritualists like Godown Moses and Wade in the Water and Oh Mary, Don't You Weep. All of these kind of provided the soundtrack for the slaves escaping. Deep River that we sang this morning is that longing for the promised land, longing for that place over Jordan. The newly declared occupant of the $20 bill, Harriet Tubman, was nicknamed Moses for her leadership of slaves out of the South. And that era of our national history is soaked in the Exodus journey. And though some might see it as co-opting a Jewish story, Jews blessed the use. And there's a wood carving by Isaac Friedlander, a Jewish Latvian, that shows the Exodus with the but showing African-American people instead of Jewish people. And in the depth of the Depression, he did that in the depth of the Depression, and reminded people of an escape to freedom, which they continued to long for. So though the theme had receded them, it remained deeply embedded in African-American consciousness. And later it came through strongly in the Civil Rights era as people marched again for freedom. Now freedom for self-determination through the vote, rather than literal freedom from bondage. And the call came from Christian preachers like Martin Luther King, of course, but also from rabbis like Abraham Joshua Heschel, who said he said these words at a 1963 conference on religion and race. He says, "At the first conference on religion and race, the main participants were Pharaoh and Moses. Moses' words were, 'Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may celebrate a feast to me.' While Pharaoh retorted, 'Who is the Lord that I should heed this voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and moreover, I will not let Israel go.' The outcome of that summit meeting has not come to an end. Pharaoh is not ready to capitulate. The Exodus began, but it is far from having been completed. In fact, it was easier for the children of Israel to cross the Red Sea than for a Negro to cross certain university campuses." Those were Heschel's words, 1963. Even the Muslim Malcolm X compared Elijah Muhammad to Moses. So Moses, Exodus, all of this. So when they used the story this way, they were not only comparing one situation to an earlier one. They were not only conjuring up inspiration, they were creating a narrative for their own journey. And countless people through the millennia have done the same. Protestants breaking away from the Catholic Church during the Reformation, South Africans as they worked to end apartheid, and of course those 20th century base communities in Latin America. Now as we live into the story, it's a really great spiritual technique, I think, living into story. We look at the symbols and we find ourselves responding in ways that we couldn't without a story. So, for example, someone looking at the story might notice that the Israelite slaves found manna to eat. Where is our manna, we might ask. And if we poke around at the question, we might discover what nourishes us? What surprising thing nourishes us? Maybe companionship or art or potlucks. The story lives through us when we adopt it as our own. Now, you probably already knew some of those uses of Exodus. But did you also know that white Southerners during the Civil War invoked the Exodus story, casting Northern oppression as the Egyptian influence, with Abe Lincoln playing Pharaoh? Similarly, the story was used by Boer voortrekkers of South Africa and Robert Mugabe's regime in Zimbabwe. And that's a reminder of how story used for inspiration can be twisted to the good or the evil side. Yet it's not a reason to lay aside a story that has given the world so much. But the story of liberation and oppression demands nuance and careful reflection as we immerse ourselves in it. And what happens to a freed people once they've escaped bondage? The promised land of milk and honey to which the Israelites journeyed required conquest. Does an exodus lead inevitably to conquest? Another comment from Abraham Heschel's 1963 speech. He said, "We are all pharaohs or slaves of Pharaoh. It is sad to be a slave of Pharaoh. It is horrible to be a pharaoh." Is what he says true? Must we all be either oppressed or oppressor? What is the liberation we seek? And can we have our liberation without oppressing someone else? we recognize how sad it is to be a slave and how horrible it is to be a pharaoh. What are the other roles we can carve out to resist both subservience and exploitation? How in our own lives in these times do we experience oppression? What do we do in response to oppression? How do we claim our freedom or freedom for others? And can we do it without drowning Pharaoh's army? At least as important, how are we playing Pharaoh in our own lives? Who do we oppress, perhaps without realizing it consciously? How can we liberate them? How do we follow Moses? Exodus, like so many other epic religious stories, invites us to experience something that transforms how we see our current situation. When I think today of those large numbers of Israelites escaping Egypt, wandering in the desert, and eventually finding a home, my heart turns to the contemporary waves of immigrants trying to leave Syria and Africa and Asia to reach Europe. For the most part, they're not escaping slavery, but they are moving away from oppression, danger, and death. Only desperation for a new way could carry such people. And that's one way we see the Exodus story being lived out before us today. At Passover, the practice is to remember all who need liberation. All who need liberation. Here are the words from one Passover Haggadah or liturgy. Long ago at this season, on such a night as this, a people, our people, set out on a journey, all but crushed by their enslavement. They yet recalled the far-off memory of a happier past, and heard the voice of their ancestral God bidding them summon up the courage to be free. Boldly they went forth from Egypt, crossed the sea, and headed through the desert for the promised land. What they experienced, they remembered and told their children, and they to theirs. From generation to generation, the story was retold, and we are here to tell it yet again. We too give thanks for Israel's liberation. We too remember what it was to be a slave. And so we pray for all who are still fettered, still denied their human rights. Let all God's children sit at his table, drink the wine of deliverance, and eat the bread of freedom. Freedom from bondage and freedom from oppression. Freedom from hunger and freedom from want. Freedom from hatred. Freedom from fear. Freedom to think and freedom to speak, freedom to learn and freedom to love, freedom to hope and freedom to rejoice, soon in our days. Amen. Our hymn is in the blue book. It's number 1014, I think. No, that's wrong. 1018. All right, 1018. Come and go with me. May there be singing in that land, freedom from bondage, freedom from oppression, freedom from hunger, freedom from want, freedom from hatred, freedom from fear, freedom to think, freedom to speak, freedom to learn and freedom to love, freedom to hope and freedom to rejoice. So may it be.